I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Our Shelves, a podcast where writers from the legendary feminist publishing house Virago talk about their cultural worlds. We'll be diving into these writers' bookshelves, record collections, and recollections to discover what inspires them. I'm Lucy Scholes, and my guest today is Daisy Johnson. Daisy is the author of one short story collection, Fen, and two novels, the latest of which, Sisters, was published early this year to much critical acclaim. Her first novel, Everything Under, was shortlisted for the 2018 Man Booker Prize, which made her the youngest writer ever to be nominated in the history of the award. She's also contributed a brilliantly eerie story to Virago's recently published collection, Hag, Forgotten Folktales Retold. Welcome to Our Shelves, Daisy. It's such a joy to be chatting to you today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's so good to be here.
I want to talk briefly about your story in Hag, retelling, because it's so deliciously dark and creepy. And I found myself completely captivated, particularly by... I can't stop thinking about, I don't want to spoil it and kind of give away anything, but I can't stop thinking about the kind of weird ending to it. And I was also thinking about this, there was a brilliant review in The Guardian recently of Sisters, where they called you the demon offspring of Shirley Jackson and Stephen King. And then I've also been listening to your interconnected sort of stories, The Hotel, on Radio 4. And again, I think I was dreaming about, I think, which is the episode about the two girls, Infestation. It really stuck with me and I can't stop thinking about that. And so I was thinking a little bit about kind of, you know, obviously the sort of genre that you write in. And I think both Fen and Everything Under have these elements of what I think some people have called sort of folk, almost sort of folk horror. Mm. But more recently, you seem to be really fully embracing the sort of gothic genre. And I wondered if you could explain a little bit about what the attraction for you is here, and whether you have any particular key influences, things that you've read or you've watched over the years that have sort of molded the way that you're writing at the moment.
Hmm. Yeah, so I've always really loved horror, and I was born on Halloween, so from a very young age, my parents, which is no surprise to anyone, my parents had these sort of epic Halloween birthdays where they'd kind of fill rooms with spider webs and we'd sort of have ghost tours around the town.
Wow.
So I quite enjoyed that sort of almost feeling of being scared, you know, that feeling of being on the edge of being frightened and not quite being sure what's there. And kind of my parents bought me my first Stephen King, and I read that in sort of, I think, awe that someone could make you feel this way and that someone could balance scenes in that way. And then when I started writing, the horror's always sort of been there underneath the surface in a lot of things I write. There's a monster, or there's something that you can't quite see, or there's some kind of truth which is just out of view. And then really I think I knew I wanted to see if I could write something more traditionally gothic and more traditionally scary. I think it was sort of an experiment for myself to see what I could do. And in particular, I think rereading Shirley Jackson, I thought I wanted to do something about the haunted house. I really love the haunted house and how it relates to the body and how Shirley Jackson kind of has these characters being trapped in these places. So that's really where a lot of things started coming from. But obviously, I think, as with every writer, you have an idea and as you write it changes, and though there are elements of the gothic in all of those things, I think they became about something else as well. Particularly Sisters, I think my novel really became about the relationship between those two girls.
I love that. I mean, I'm absolutely fascinated by siblings at the best of times, but I was wondering, it's a maybe a slightly random question, but have you ever read Daphne du Maurier's novel, The Parasites. I don't know if you've come across this before. It's a Virago modern classic, so, you know, topical in more ways than one here. But it's the only other novel that I can think of where it's, I think the beginning, the first sort of section of Sisters, if I remember correctly, it's sort of narrated in the first person plural, the we, between the September and July, the sisters. The Parasites, I think, is such a wonderful book. It's about these three siblings, very different setup, very different kind of genre, but it's narrated in this first person collective. And I've never come across this before, this we. And I love the idea of siblings that are so close together, so interconnected that you can kind of be in each other's mind almost. I think maybe you'd be interested in it slightly if you're thinking about those relationships. Obviously, you're probably done with Sisters now that it's, you wrote it a long time ago and it's out in the world. But anyway.
Yeah, I'd love to read that. That sounds brilliant. I think the wee voice is really creepy and also really difficult to do. And I, it always makes me think of, I guess, Virgin Suicides by
Yes.
And that sort of a voice which I guess becomes a voice for the generation and for the times they're living in. And I think that's also what I wanted to do with Sisters, was sort of talk about what it is to live now with social media and how that changes your relationship to one another, and this sort of the certainty of the internet, which actually isn't very certain at all. But I also, coincidentally, I think read Daphne du Maurier's Don't Look Now. Have you read?
Yes.
So, and I didn't know she'd written it. I'd seen the sort of very sexy film. The person who wrote it. And I think that sort of that sense of what horror does to place, I think, is so fascinating. And how I never thought of Venice as a scary place, I don't think, until I read that. And then I thought, actually, of course, it is quite creepy. And, you know, it's very easy to get lost. The signs all point in different directions. And I think horror can take very banal things, very domestic things almost, and make them incredibly frightening.
Well, I think that links in with one of the things I was thinking about how you write horror so well, is that your work is very grounded in reality. Like you were saying, that the elements of social media that come into play in Sisters, the short stories, Fen, even Everything Under, it's so grounded in the sort of in a recognizable reality, whether it's, you know, somebody using the microwave to cook something, or whether it is this kind of element of social media, all these various things. And then I think what you draw on so well is that then when it snaps into the sort of the horror, you get this sense of the sort of unheimlich, you know, the uncanny, where the familiar suddenly becomes unfamiliar. And that for me is, you know, the cornerstone of the genre. Like, you have to be able to, if you start out in sort of obviously a scare, you know, maybe I'm, I don't know, something like, you know, Shirley Jackson, The Haunting of Hill House, it does it really well because it has got the haunted house in the beginning. But you have to be such a master to do that. And actually, often I find that things that are scarier, the things that you think you recognize, you think you know, and then they turn on you in that way, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that's a brilliant way of putting it.
And I like what you're saying about Venice as well. It's such a, because yes, of course, there's so many ideas about it being a wonderfully romantic city, a kind of a place you know go and there's lots of light and lots of, you know, and actually what du Maurier did was turn it on its head and show you this really dark side of it. I'm still surprised in a way that more people don't know that she wrote that, weirdly. And I think The Birds as well, a lot of people don't have any idea that she wrote the original short story that the Hitchcock film is based on, which is brilliant. And in a way, I think, I don't know, I haven't read it for a while, but to me, I always thought it was more creepy than the film. And the film is brilliant, but, you know, just shows what you can do with a great story, I suppose.
I didn't know that she'd written The Birds. That's really amazing. I'll have to find it.
No, find it.
Yeah, it seems like some of her more culty things have been a bit buried. Some of the more traditional horror stuff has been a bit hidden underneath Rebecca, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's it. And I think a lot of people don't know about all the different genres she wrote in, because she's written sort of weird sci-fi. She wrote a sort of Brexit novel years before Brexit. But I think the horror stories are actually really, really good. A lot of the short stories. And The Birds is set in Cornwall, so very different to the West Coast, isn't it? It's kind of up past San Francisco, the film is set. So it's a very different environment, but the kind of creepy sort of cold Cornish environment with the farms and it works brilliantly. It's, yeah, terribly. I almost don't want to read it again because I remember being so shocked the first time round.
Yeah, anyway. I'll
yeah, give it a go. I think you might like it. I think you might like it a lot. Right, let's push on with the questions then. Otherwise, I feel like we'd be talking about, it turns into a sort of du Maurier fan club podcast, which is not a bad thing, but something slightly different to what we're supposed to be doing, perhaps. So first up, Daisy, I wanted to ask you, what books are currently on your bedside table?
Yeah, so my bedside table, I think, like a lot of people's, at the moment is a complete mess. It's sort of an explosion of everything I want to read and everything I'm trying to reread. So I'm rereading Self-Portrait by Celia Paul at the moment, which is this book about, non-fiction book by Celia Paul about her experience being an artist, but also being, for quite a long time, Lucian Freud's girlfriend and then the mother of his child. And is brilliant, I think, on this sense in the art world that perhaps as a woman you can't be a woman, and as an artist there's something you have to give away. And I think, you know, it is that sort of idea of the pram in the hallway, but even larger, that I think at times Celia Paul sort of talks about having to give away some of the idea of gender or sexuality at all to make art. And also I think very interesting on the idea of, there's a lot of bits in the book of her drawing her child and then also, and kind of wondering whether she should be doing this, and, you know, what we do to the people around us when we put them into our art, which I think is always relevant for writers, because I think inevitably you steal things, you know, writers are magpies, and stuff appears in the writing even if you don't mean it to. I've also been reading Poor by Caleb Femi, which is this collection of poetry about where he grew up in London, this sort of group of concrete towers which are all joined at the top, so you don't have to go down to the ground, and which were destroyed a while ago, but sort of his experience of growing up there and being a black man, and it has these wonderful thoughts about kind of the porousness of concrete, and it's written almost like I think nature poetry, but it is about these sort of concrete towers.
Those are both really fascinating. Do you read a lot of poetry? Is it something that you're quite a fan of?
I actually didn't before this year read very much poetry or nonfiction, and I'm trying to fix that a bit. I'm trying to kind of widen my gaze a little bit, and really, really enjoying it, I think.
Do you think, is that important? Did you feel that it was both poetry and nonfiction were sort of missing in your life, and that you were maybe missing books that, you know, would just bring something to it? Or was it kind of conscious decision as a writer that you wanted to kind of see how other people were doing their side of things?
Yeah, I felt like I was missing experiences both as a reader and also as a writer, you know, that I was only reading the sort of novels that I wanted to write, and actually I was missing out a lot of things which were very interesting and which I would add stuff to my practice, and particularly this year I've been trying to read books about writers and about how writers write, and sort of books about what that means to be a writer. And I think that's been really, really helpful, trying to look at it at a different angle. I think sometimes as a writer you can get quite myopic and you can think what is going to be helpful for this book at this moment, but actually spreading your gaze wider I think is sometimes really useful.
Do you find that you I suppose I'm interested to know whether you feel that you do you learn things that you think you're going to kind of bring into your practice, or is it more that you're interested in working out how other people do the same thing to you, basically?
Yeah, I think I constantly learn things that I bring into the practice, and it can be the most, you know, arbitrary thing that you think isn't going to appear, and then later it appears in something and you think, actually, you know, you as a person you're taking in everything all of the time. And I think people are very porous and they take in things even when they're not really noticing, and trying to be open to that and to research which comes even when you're not purposefully researching, I think has been really important this year.
I think I want to talk more about the Celia Paul book and probably her as a writer, as a writer and as an artist. But I think this is going to link into the next question I'm going to ask you, because I'm about a recent article that's made you think something you've been thinking about.
Yeah. So this again was about Celia Paul. This was an article that Rachel Cusk wrote about Celia Paul and also Cecily Brown. And again, I think sort of exploring the idea of gender as an artist and being a woman as an artist, and I suppose as a creative, although specifically as an artist, and it caused a lot of I guess furore when it came out. I read it slightly later, so I missed some of the stuff, but it caused a lot of kind of anger, I guess, and it's quite a critical article, I think, particularly about Celia Paul and about her relationship with Freud and about this sort of sense that she's given away a lot of her life to be an artist, and is that something that you should do? And is that something that men maybe don't do to be artists, and actually that, you know, it's something that we should fight against as women, that you don't necessarily have to live alone in an apartment and, you know, not see your children to be a woman and an artist.
Yeah, I remember the furore that it caused. And I think I found it kind of interesting because I think in a way, Cusk was asking all the right questions, but I think it seemed like she had quite a strong agenda behind her. She uses some quite emotive, I think at one point she describes Celia Paul, who gave him away, but when she had a child, she got her mother to raise him during his early years, and she devoted her time to being an artist, which to me, I think is quite a radical, impressive, you know, decision to make. Whether it's a right or wrong decision is not really the point. It's, you know, but Cusk describes it as a sort of an act of self-harm on Paul's behalf, which I found quite, I don't know, maybe I found that strange, because reading Self-Portrait, I remember being, personally, I was much more struck by what Paul described, her relationship with her mother and her sisters. These were so important to her, and the way that she keeps painting them throughout her life and still does to this day. I was much more fascinated by those relationships than the sort of much more, I don't know, like traditional relationship she had with Freud, or not traditional, but stereotypical in a way, the kind of classic older man, younger woman. Mm-hmm. But then to read the Cusk article, she seemed so hung up on this, but I don't know, maybe coming to it afterwards, what did you feel like?
Yeah, I think it was so interesting that Rachel Cusk was the one to write it, because Rachel Cusk's whole sort of oeuvre in the last few years seems to be about writing about the people she knows in very personal ways. And so it seems very interesting for her to sort of be commenting on that, because I think that's something that comes up in Celia Paul's work, is, you know, she has that really beautiful painting of, yeah, her and her sisters sort of as a mourning painting after their mother.
Yes.
And this kind of idea of, is that something that's okay? You know, can you do that to the people you love? And which is something that Rachel Cusk does often, I think. You know, she takes the things that have happened to her, but also the things that have happened to her sons and to her husband or her ex-husband, and uses them in her work. Yeah, so it seemed like a very interesting person to write that particular article, and I think brought that up for me. You know, and also I guess I was reading Nausgaard at the same time for the first time, and this idea of how much is too much to do for your art, I think is really interesting. But I love how you frame the Celia Paul as about the women that she's connected to, because I think you're right. I think that's really beautiful. And her relationship with the women in her family is very intense and really, really amazing, I think.
I think so. I mean, maybe I'm bringing it up now partly because obviously your novel Sisters is on my mind, but there are, I think these, I don't know, with Paul, it just felt that relationship with her mother is so sort of tender and beautiful, but also traumatic. But they have such a connection over the years, and the sort of sitting that the mother did for her time and time and time again, and looking after her child. There's something so sort of incredible there that I just don't think, it's not the kind of relationship that I've read about before, and certainly not in such a kind of raw manner. I don't know. It was the thing that stuck with me most about it. But you, I think you, is there a particular reason that you've been revisiting the Celia Paul material recently?
Yeah, it's research for a new project for the next book, okay. Actually, which is in the very early days. So it's probably going to change enormously and be a lot deleted. But it is really about, I suppose, it's so interesting, I think, because at almost every event I go to, and I, you know, the characters in my book are often, I guess, unpleasant to the people that they're around. But every event I go to, someone asks me, you know, what's your relationship with your mother like? What does your sister feel about this book? And so this, I began to become really interested in this idea of autobiography in fiction, and the presumption that women are writing autobiography in fiction, and also how much are you allowed to do that? You know, I think my novels are not autobiographical, but inevitably there are bits of myself in them, and is that something that's okay to do? You know, should you check with the people that you're doing that with? You know, is Nausgaard completely out of line to to write these books about his ex-wife, which are very traumatic for her, I think? And where are sort of the lines of that, and how much are we allowed to do to the people around us to kind of benefit our own creativity? Is creativity kind of above and beyond all the thing that we should all be striving for?
Do you feel affronted when people ask you those questions? Like, you know, what's your relationship with your mother like? What's your relationship with your sisters like? Because it's sort of so... I can understand why people are interested. As a very nosy person myself, like I get that sort of underlying principle, but I also feel that it's what your relationships are like in real life has absolutely no bearing in so many ways on what you write. I mean, fiction is fiction, right? Like, of course you're going to bring things from your own life into it, but it does seem that women in particular get asked these questions over and over again. There must be an element of frustration there, I would imagine.
It's particularly funny with my mum because, especially for Everything Under, she came with me for a lot of the events. So she was often in the audience and she just sort of had this very bemused expression on her face, because I suppose there's two ways that you're going to answer that question. Either you're going to say, no, there's no relationship to my mum. I have a very good relationship with my mother, which I do. Or you're going to say, yeah, I have a very traumatic relationship with my mother. I had an awful childhood. Let me tell you about the awful things that happened to me. So it seems a funny question to ask. And I think you're right that women get asked it more. And the presumption behind that seems to be that women can only write things that come from them. Mm. You know, we're sort of emotionally stymied and lacking in imagination enough that we can only write about the things that happen around us, which is not true. And I don't quite know where that idea has come from, but it is something that arises again and again. And I think there are really brilliant writers who are sort of using that presumption a little bit. I spoke to Lauren Groff, the writer, about this a while ago. Her short story collection has throughout it these two young boys. And she kind of said, you know, I have two young boys. And the reason that I put them in there was because I knew that people were going to presume they were mine. But they're not mine. They're just two young boys. And sort of actually using this and playing on that idea that people are obsessed with something having to be true for it to have some kind of basis.
Well, in a way, I think, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but you seem to be doing something like that in retelling the story in Hag, right? Because it's a sort of frame story in itself, that it starts out with a writer talking about trying to write a retelling of the story that you're doing. And so you're, as a reader, you're sort of lulled into this false sense of thinking, oh, I'm reading about, you know, Daisy Johnson telling me about what it's like to write this story. And then very quickly, you sort of come to realize, of course, this isn't Daisy Johnson, the novelist who's, you know, in the story. So you're sort of twisting, you're playing with our expectations there as well.
Yeah, and the beginning of that story is sort of true. My family live very close to the place where the story's set, and we did one Christmas, some of us drive down there and sort of have a stomp around and have a look and see what we could see. And I really did want to, yeah, take this idea of what's real and what's not real and begin to... play a little bit on the reader's expectations, as you said.
And in reference to the other sort of side of things you're talking about, this idea of how much you can use other people's experiences or lives or what you know about them in your fiction, I'm not going to ask you too much about this new project, obviously, but has any of the reading that you've done so far, has it sort of changed your thoughts on this or made you think about things slightly slightly differently?
Interesting. Yeah, I think it has. I think that you have to step with care a little bit. And, you know, writers can use whatever they want, but certainly for me, writing was for a very long time the most important thing, you know, in my life. And I think that's changed now. You know, I think as you get older, you make more connections, you begin a family, your family is increasingly more and more important to you. And so I think, I think it has changed what I think about that. And I think it's made me, think about what I can put into the writing. But I think this whole year has made me change my ideas on writing. And certainly, you know, I think something about being stuck inside all the time, my sentences seem very different. And I think it's my fourth book I'm working on now. And I think a lot of the things that I did when I was writing my first book, I wouldn't do again. Yeah,
I wonder how much of this is also a sort of growing process that we all go through. That sense of, I don't know. I mean, I think looking back on how one behaves when one's younger, you have the world is a smaller place in a sense. You haven't kind of met so many people. You haven't experienced so much. There's something about that sense of realizing that other people's lives are as full as one's own. I want to ask you, maybe moving slightly out of talking about your own sort of work and process, can you tell me about a film or a song or a TV series that you've been enjoying lately?
Yeah, so I, like a lot of people, I suppose, have mostly not been leaving the house apart from to go for walks. So I've been sort of stomping very grumpily along the river and getting very muddy. And I've been listening a lot to Gazelle Twins Pastoral, which I don't know if you've heard, but feels particularly as a lot of Brexit stuff is happening and a lot of sort of, you know, I guess we could describe it as small town racism. It feels very, very relevant to that. And it's this album, which kind of brings in a lot of different voices, this kind of plethora of voices which combine and, you know, almost this sort of hysteria, I think, is what it's about, and is really brilliant and is, I guess, a very angry album, which felt very relevant to the, yeah, to what some of us are feeling.
Do you always listen to music when you're walking, or do you ever listen to audiobooks or podcasts?
Yeah, I listen to a lot of audiobooks. I'm listening to The Queen's Gambit at the moment, which I finished the TV series of, and then was like, that was, and you know, kind of felt very astounded by how it was plotted, so I wanted to see how the writer had done it, and that's really interesting. I've been listening to a lot of Literary Friction, who do brilliant podcasts with writers. But increasingly, I think our brains all feel very full at the moment. I think there's a lot of things going on, a lot swirling around, and I think music is really helpful in that way to silence some of that stuff.
Yeah, I'm always, when I go for walks, I tend to listen to audiobooks or podcasts, but then sometimes I think maybe I should just be communing with nature in a, I don't, or, you know, just having a bit of a break from it all, because I think being stuck at home, you're right, all the time, I feel like I'm always sort of reading, watching a film, watching TV, doing something, and maybe I just need a break, but then I feel like I'm wasting my time somewhat, so I don't know. Yeah, it's a tricky one, but that's a great recommendation for an album. I think you also mentioned that you've been watching quite a lot of Penelope Cruz films as well, is that right?
Yeah, so I was I was watching a lot of real crap kind of on television and on films. And I was like, you know, this is not making me feel very good. It's sort of making me feel like my brain's rotting a bit. So watched the film Everybody Knows, which she is in, and which is about her daughter is kidnapped. And she's in a small town. She's sort of gone home to this small Spanish town. A lot of things from the past are sort of rising up. She's just so brilliant, and I think the films she's in are so good on family drama and family dynamics. So I've been then now slowly beginning to revisit some of Amaldiwar, which is such a pleasure. And they're so much funnier than I remember them being as well.
Yeah, I think there is that. It's quite good to have a mission like that, or a kind of organized sense of, right, I'm going to watch these, because there is so much television out there that you can easily get sucked into things that are not so great, let's say. I mean, speaking from my own experience of a year of sitting here watching a lot of telly as well. But, you know, you also said you watched The Queen's Gambit, which I think everyone's been enjoying quite a lot. So there's something there. Lots of different options. Do you speak Spanish at all when you watch the Penelope Cruz films, or are you watching them?
Okay. Yeah, sadly not. Do you speak Spanish?
No, God, I wish I could. I'm just wondering whether, I suppose, I imagine there's lots of people, maybe there's not, but I have this idea that other people in lockdown are sort of doing, bettering themselves, let's say, sort of, you know, learning Spanish by watching lots of Penelope Cruz films or this, that and the other. And whereas I'm just sat here watching Bake Off, which, you know, is great fun, but...
Yeah, maybe. I feel like maybe the first lockdown we were all slightly better. We were all like, we're going to teach ourselves to make bread and we're going to do all of these things. And then by this lockdown, you know, yeah, it's interesting you're talking about sort of having challenges in films. My partner and I watched all the Mission Impossible films, and by the end I was just like, I don't know why we're doing this to ourselves. Like, they're not good. They're making us feel really sad.
It's tricky though, isn't it? I think finding the balance between watching something that is sort of escapist and maybe sometimes a bit silly, and something that you don't really want your brain to work too hard on, particularly if you have spent the day writing or reading or that sort of thing anyway, and then sort of feeling after, yeah, how many nights of Mission Impossible that maybe I need to watch something. I mean, we've all been there, so there's no, I'm not I have watched some terrible things this year. I'm not ashamed to admit it. I mean, I am ashamed to admit it, but I'll still say it. Arshelle will be back in just a moment.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome back to Our Shelves. I'm Lucy Scholes, and I've been talking to Daisy Johnson about the terrible films we've watched in lockdown, but we're also trying to better ourselves and watch more intellectually stimulating things these days. Next up, Daisy, I've asked you to pick a photograph that you treasure. Could you describe it to me and tell me a little bit about it, please?
Yeah, so I felt a bit stumped by this question. And I was like, oh, I want to think of something clever that Lucy will be really impressed with. And so I thought about Francesca Woodman, who I looked at a lot of her photos when I was writing Sisters, and they were really impressive to me. But actually, I think there's a photo on my wall, which is my parents looking very, very young. I think they're probably about 27, 28. And it's them with me in the middle, and I'm on one of those sort of crazy baby bouncing things that you hang from the frame of a door. And I think just in this year, I've been a lot luckier than a lot of people. I know some people haven't seen their parents all year, and my parents live about 2 hours away, so in better times I've been able to see them, but much less than I normally would. So I think it's been very important to have those sort of reminders of them around, and to be able to ring them and talk to them. I'm pregnant, so it's strange looking at that photo of them with a baby and then thinking about me having a baby. You know, my mum and I have been having some conversations about what happens to your children when they have children, and are they still children, and you know, is she still a mother in the same way? And I think that's all sort of been swirling around my head a little bit.
Is this going to be her first grandchild?
It is, yes, the first grandchild on either side of our,
Okay, so it's going to be, it'll be a lot of different emotions then. I think that makes perfect sense. It's interesting, so many of the guests we've had on the show so far have chosen photos of their family, and often photos in which their parents are younger, or and sometimes there is a child in there. And I think so many people have spoken eloquently about these photos being wonderful sort of portals into the life that their parents had before they were parents, if that makes sense. And I think, I don't know, even just thinking about what you're saying now, this idea that now you'll be looking at that photo and thinking, you know, I'm now going to be the mother, and the sort of the difference between how does that change the family dynamics? And I think it's sort of fascinating that these photos seem to they sort of hold all these different stories of different people at different points in their lives. And they are different people in a way. Like your parents before they were your parents would be different people. You before you become a parent will be a different person, a person that your child will never know. And that, I don't know, that I sort of find that fascinating.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I think you definitely have that sort of strange moment with your parents where for a long time you don't really see them as separate people from yourself. You know, they're just part, they're the people who bring you food and they're part of you. And then, yeah, looking at photos like that when does make you realize that they're entirely different people. And we spoke a little bit about, I guess, empathizing with the people around you a little bit more, which I think happens more and more as you get older. And I suppose happens as you write as well, fiction and nonfiction and, you know, and anything, I think. Yeah, beginning to kind of see the boundaries of yourself and see the boundaries of other people. And yeah, which is sometimes hard with your parents because they are also the people who should always be there for you, you know, and they should do whatever you want them to do.
Did your mum, has she had any answer yet about whether she thinks does she think her relationship with you is going to change drastically, or is she still just not sure about what's going to happen?
Yeah, she said we're very, very close and we talk a lot, and I think she thinks it will change. And so obviously she's very excited, but I think both of us are also a bit we're losing something at the same time as gaining something. But mostly I think she's just excited, and she began before I got pregnant very firmly saying I'm not going to do any babysitting, you know, like, and that has definitely changed a lot as we've gone along. I think I'm going to have to throw her out of the house at some point. So
no, this is all good. You need to run with it. Like, you know, the more that she spends, you know, that's great. That's really good. You'll be very grateful for it, I'm sure, when it actually arrives.
Yeah, it's going to be very, very helpful. I think by the time maybe I'm one of three, so maybe by the time my brothers had children, the sort of allure of the baby might have worn off a bit. So I'm very lucky.
Exactly. Get the babysitting in while you can, because if it was later down the line, she'd have her fill by that point. So next up, I want to ask you about, could you name a novel, tell me a little bit about it and why, that you always recommend to friends?
Yeah, so this was a hard question because I think the novels that I recommend to friends change a lot, mostly because I suppose I am friends with people who read the same sort of things, so we're always sharing books back and forth and lending books. But the book that I would give, I think, to a new friend is probably a book that I read when I was a teenager and sort of I blew my mind in that way that maybe only your mind can be blown when you're a teenager reading a book. And it's called Miss Miller's Feeling for Snow by Peter Hoag.
Yes, I remember. This was a book, it was very, I'm not as young as you by any stretch, but I remember being sort of young when it came out, I think. And people loved it, didn't they?
Yeah, I think it's just completely brilliant. And I've tried to read some of his others and he hasn't succeeded in quite the same way with any other book apart from this one. But it's, this sort of crime thriller set in very, very cold Copenhagen, but also very weird and kind of on the edge of real at times. It's just completely brilliant.
I don't know if I'm right in thinking this, but also it seems, I mean, the sort of idea of a sort of noir chiller, you know, sort of those kind of things that are set in Northern European countries has become very popular in recent years, but this was quite early. It was sort of not, it wasn't riding that wave, as it were. It was kind of before that, wasn't it? And it's a very literary book as well.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't even think about it like that, but it definitely shares a lot with the sort of, yeah, the Danish crime dramas that we're all watching. And so the main character is definitely the kind of main character who would be in one of those, you know, very solitary and difficult. And yeah, maybe a little bit obsessive and yeah.
Yeah, I feel like it's not, considering how popular it seemed at the time, I don't hear it mentioned quite so much these days when other people in that, I mean, it's different, but the sort of Joe Nesbo type, you know, that sort of Northern European crime stuff, and I suppose TV series as well, there's been so many of them. But this is probably something that I imagine our listeners will, if they haven't heard of it, will be keen to go back to. It's a great recommendation, actually. Makes me want to go back and read it again. It's been such a long time.
Yeah, I used to read it once a year, and that sort of faded away. But I wonder if it's not recommended in the same vein as those because it's quite slow. You know, part of its charm is the sort of this, you know, kind of four pages of a man making very beautiful coffee. And it's kind of very, like, almost domestically boring, which I really found very moving when I first read it, I think.
Yeah, you're right. I'm sort of throwing it in with other things, but it's got elements, but definitely not exactly the same. Once a year to reread something, it's that's quite often in a way. I mean, did you find that you were getting something new from it each time, or was there the feeling of coming back to something that you knew would be a sort of comfort read, for want of a better word?
Yeah, so I haven't done this for a while, but when I was in my early 20s, I was reading it every year, and I think it was I guess at that point you're changing so much, aren't you, and you're different almost every week, and life's changing around you, so rereading a book is this sort of strange thing where the book hasn't changed but you maybe have, and the things that you pick up from the book are very different. But also I love rereading, and I think I've been rereading a lot of things this year because it is comforting to know the plot, and so to sort of be able to look for different things in the writing and see what else you can find.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. A lot of people have been rereading stuff. I guess it's safer and more. I certainly did a bit of myself at the beginning of the first lockdown of rereading. I was rereading a lot of Joan Aiken's children's books because they were so, I think for that reason, they were so comforting, and it was just the idea that I'd be wrapped up in the story for a while and would know I would enjoy it in a way. Next up, I want to ask you if you could tell me about a book or books that have made you think about feminism in a new way. I'm always fascinated by the answers to this question. People choose such different books, and often things that I don't think of at all. So,
interesting. I'd be interested to. I'll have to listen what other people have said, but because I've been pregnant, and I'm a bit of a manic planner, which is both helpful when you're pregnant and unhelpful. There's an awful Will Smith phrase, which is something like, be prepared so you don't have to get prepared, which I found myself sort of like shouting at my partner over the last few months. So I've been trying to read a lot of books, but also be a very relaxed person, and thinking a lot about motherhood. And one book I read recently was I'm Not Your Baby Daddy by Candice Braithwaite, which is a book about the Black British experience of having a child, and how people should go read the book, because I'm not going to explain it as well as she does, but the figures of the figures of death for Black children are so much higher, and the experiences of Black women in hospital are, you know, exponentially worse than the experience of white women in hospital. And I think it really, you know, I think pregnancy makes you think a lot about what it is to be a woman. And I think it was very important for me to then go off down that lane and think about it from that point of view as well, you know, think about the privilege of pregnancy. And you really do notice, I think, when you start reading pregnancy books, that every single baby in the book is white, and able-bodied, and that's a strange thing to realize, I think.
Yeah. Have you been, because right, obviously that's non-fiction, but there's been a sort of, in the last few years, there's been such a push towards writers exploring ideas of motherhood in both fiction and non-fiction, I think. And have these been books that you've been reading along the way and interested in before you were pregnant, or is it, are they things that you're maybe coming to now for the first time?
The last couple of years I read a lot of the ones that were coming out, I think, and particularly the ones which were maybe ambivalent about the idea of having a child. You know, the Sheila Hetty was really, really interesting, and there's also the Rachel Cusk wrote one about the, which is a brilliant book, I think, but quite quite confronting, I think, when you're about to have a baby.
Yes, I had a friend who was reading a lot of stuff when his partner was pregnant, and I recommended The Cusk to him, and then I wished I sort of hadn't afterwards, when he came back to me and said that was a weird book to thrust my way.
But I think it's really good to, you know, think about the reasons why you've decided to have a child, and I think it is interesting that a lot of writers are thinking about these things and discussing them. And, you know, I think it was I've always been interested in motherhood because I think it's very noticeable when you reach a certain age, some people start asking you whether you're going to have a baby, and, you know, what are you going to call your baby girl, and like, and this sort of strange pressure and inevitability which I fought against for a really long time, because it feels like men don't really get asked that question, you know, about whether they want children. Whereas, you know, I think as soon as you look like you might be childbearing as a woman, it's almost a constant refrain, which is something quite heavy to carry with you, I think, when you're a young woman.
Yeah, no, I think absolutely. And I feel like a lot of the recent writers that have been exploring motherhood have been pushing back on that as much as sort of leaning into it, let's say, that they are. There's been some really good books that have been quite honest and raw about motherhood, like the ups and the downs, but also there's been that sense of saying, yeah, that it's not a sort of inevitability, and it's also not anyone's business unless I want it to be, and all these kind of, I don't know, I think it's been a really, I think as a reader, it's been a really interesting period to be able to kind of explore the topic via such a kind of wealth of excellent writing. So much of it has been really, really good. And I sort of wonder what's going to happen next. Are these books going to continue, or is there going to be another wave of something different? You know, because things seem to come in these great waves, and I don't know. Like, as a writer, I suppose I'm interested. Do you feel like, not obviously everything's been said about motherhood, but does it make you quite keen to potentially write about your own experiences, or find a way of threading them into your work? Or do you think that you'll want to keep a distance between the lived experience and what you're writing about on the page?
Yeah, I think it's such a massive experience that inevitably you do think about it on the page and think about how you would write about it. But at the same time, I think I don't agree with the kind of like, oh, every story's already been told and, you know, there's nothing new to say in writing. But it feels like there's been a lot of talk about motherhood. And in potentially very similar ways, the Candace Braithwaite being a different one than this, but, you know, it kind of exploring the same vein, and in that kind of slightly unpleasant way that feminism, particularly British feminism, sometimes does have. It seems to be, you know, women setting themselves against one another, kind of like, you know, you're either very angry about the idea that you have to have children, or you're very angry about the idea that you don't have to have children. And I think I kind of hope that the writing finds this sort of inner ground maybe a little bit in the next few years. But yeah, as you say, it's a really interesting time to be a reader and to see how these books all respond to one another and hopefully maybe move out of the echo chamber of it a little bit.
Yeah, maybe that's it. There's just a slight sense that actually the story needs to be expanded slightly, whether that, and like you say, it goes back to something you were saying at the beginning about so many of these stories are about having you know, there are most of the babies that are written about are white babies, they're able-bodied. There's a sort of sense of sameness about some of these things. And I think, I don't know, it's not, I mean, it's sort of tangentially related, but I remember the Sheila Hetty, for example, I felt quite sort of astonished in a sense that so many of the reviews about that book were written by women who were mothers, and they would bring their mother, their experience of being mothers, into their reading, which obviously makes sense, but it seemed odd that there were fewer kind of single or women, you know, who decided to be childless or child free, however you want to describe it, who were talking about that book. That I don't know, there's a big sense of who owns what, this discourse, I think, going around, which is still quite uncomfortable in lots of ways. Yeah,
and it seems very unhelpful for the discourse, which I think could be very interesting and very, you know, move us forward in feminism, which we certainly need to do. But instead, we are sort of trapped a little in this stone throwing place of, well, you made the wrong decision. No, you made the wrong decision. And certainly, I don't think that's what it should be about. You know, I think it should be about that we're all being pushed to do particular things, or to do them in a particular way, you know, to be a good mother in a particular way, or to be child free in a particular way. But those are both the same thing, you know. Those are both women sort of being told how to use their bodies. Yeah, so it does seem strange that we've taken these sort of very, very strong, different, like, sides of it, if that makes sense.
No, definitely. Well, let's hope that the next sort of the next wave of books about mothering, motherhood, however you want to put it, sort of not being mothers, being mothers, is a slightly more expanded version. I suppose, I mean, that's what happens. You have to kind of break the first barrier in order to get to the second one, don't you? And so these have been important in lots of ways, but yeah, moving on. And finally, Daisy, the last question I have for you today is probably another tricky one, but I wanted to ask you to name a woman you admire and tell us why.
Yeah, I don't know why I found this one so hard. This one kept me awake at night. I think because there are so many.
Sorry.
No, as in, I think that's a good thing. I think there are so many women to admire at the moment, you know, and I think I really wanted to sort of, talk about someone, I guess, like Juno Dawson, or, you know, women in the trans community who I think are having a really hard time at the moment, and who I think are, you know, constantly being put under a lot of pressure to verbalize things. But at the same time, I also wasn't entirely sure whether I was the right person to have that conversation. So I've gone for someone a little bit I've gone for someone else, I think, which also takes us back to kind of the idea of motherhood and a person. And it's Shirley Jackson, who it is maybe not the most exciting person.
No, this is a great pick. She's a great pick. Don't worry.
Who I've been rereading a lot of her essays. And she writes these incredibly funny essays about motherhood, and then also writes these very these essays about writing and about, you know, she says, I don't want to write these essays about motherhood. I want people to know that I'm, you know, I'm a crazy woman who lives in a house with a ghost. And this sort of battle she has between the two, which I think is doing a lot of things that the books are talking about, you know, all these motherhood books that we're talking about, they're doing now, but that she was doing a really long time ago. You know, she was the breadwinner in her family for most of her life, I think. And I think found writing very, very difficult. And found motherhood quite difficult, and the sort of like the lines between those things, I think she's just completely brilliant on.
No, she's great. Have you read the Ruth Franklin biography of her, the A Haunted Life, A Rather Haunted Life? I think that's what it's called.
Yeah,
it's so good. It's such a good book. But also, I think one of the things that really struck me in that is it's a little thing, but Franklin's description of Jackson's writing about her children raising demons and life among the savages. She describes them as sort of the earliest iterations of like mommy blogs that we'd recognize today. And it's so true. It's so spot on, but also it's been sort of forgotten and neglected over the years that this was this other side to her, and was the side of her writing that was really, it was the thing that made her the most money, wasn't it, during her lifetime, and made her the most popular. Whereas today we recognize the novels maybe slightly more. But I think Penguin is republishing, is it Life Among the Savages or Raising Demons as a Penguin classic next year? So hopefully we'll see more interest in those.
That's exciting. Yeah, she seems, and I think the Ruth Franklin's so good on, I read it quite recently, on that we really tried to, and I think this happens with, you know, writers like Angela Carter and Sylvia Plath as well, we really tried to pin them down in a very particular, you know, like, this is who they were and this is the most important thing about them. And I think often we focus on, focus on Shirley Jackson being, you know, she couldn't leave the house, and there's sort of these, at the time everyone was obsessed with the idea that she was maybe a witch and that she was sort of cursing people. And I think the Ruth Franklin book is so good on seeing what else actually that she's about. And that there's a lot more going on there, which I think is really important, thinking about women writers from that generation, is kind of what else is around them at the time and how are they relating to the things that are happening and how forward thinking are they.
Yeah, and doesn't Franklin also is very good at putting Jackson in a large tradition of sort of creepy American writing, whether it's Hawthorne, Poe, Henry James. Like, she sort of gives her the due that other people haven't given her in that sense as well, of saying, you know, here's someone who's really, really good at her craft. Have you seen the Josephine Decker film, Shirley, that's just come out? What did you think of that, just briefly?
Yeah, I was really ready to love it, and I didn't love it. I didn't hate it. I think that it is interesting because it's based on a novel, I think, isn't it? And it's not supposed to be entirely realistic. It's supposed to sort of be a bit of a take on the story. And I think it could have pushed that a bit further. You know, I think if you're going to take a biography and sort of play around with it and break some things, then you should almost go the whole way. I don't know. What did you think about it?
I actually quite liked it. I think I'm quite a fan of Decker's work anyway, so I like her sort of creepy, weird style. that, you know, I think a lot of people describe it as experimental. It's not quite, but it, you know, that, I don't know. I think it's, no, I mean, no, I did like it. I could see why someone, why what you're saying makes sense though, that if you're going to break something down, you might as well go a bit further because it clung to certain things and not to others. And I suppose there's always that question of why did you, like, why get rid of all the children, but then, you know, leave these other elements. But for me, it quite worked. I just think, I mean, I think, you know, Sarah, what's her name? I've suddenly forgotten.
Elizabeth Moss.
Yeah, sorry, Elizabeth. I don't know why I was calling her Sarah Moss. I'm getting muddled. With, yeah, too many good Mosses out there. But I thought Elizabeth Moss was so good in it as Shirley. And the guy who played her husband, who I can't remember his name right now, but I thought they were both really excellent. And again, I think I liked it because I liked the fact that you sort of thought that it was going to be about their relationship, and it was to a certain degree, but actually what was more important was the relationship between Shirley and the younger woman who comes to stay in her house.
I think Elizabeth Moss is brilliant. And certainly they get the atmosphere of the house really spot on. I think, you know, it's I was kind of at some point trying to turn up the light on my screen, but actually,
right,
it's just a really dark, shady film, which I think works so well, and does it feels like a Shirley Jackson house that she might write about, which I think
is, yes, yeah, though in a way, now you've mentioned it, I'd sort of love to see your version of a fictionalized version of Shirley Jackson's life as told by Daisy Johnson. I think could be incredible. So
that would be really fun. I will give you a percentage if that's my next.
Please do. I mean, just write it. I'd just love to read it. I think that you'd be the perfect person to write that. Well, thank you so much, Daisy. It's been a real pleasure talking to you today, and for answering all our questions, even the tricky ones. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. So good to talk to you.
Thank you for listening. Our Shelves is brought to you by the team at Virago Press. Special thanks to today's guest, Daisy Johnson. Tune in next time for more conversation about books, feminism, and culture.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.